As I mentioned, we're going to be looking at one of the What Does the Bible Say About lessons. This was actually turned in on multiple cards. So several had the same question regarding this particular passage, and I thought, well, I've put it off about as long as I could. Let's go ahead and open it up and kind of dive into that tonight. If you want to be turning in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, we're going to be looking at what does the Bible say about women and the head covering in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I want you to read with me, if you would, starting in verse 1 of chapter 11, and we're going to go down through verse 16, then we'll come back and make the points that we want to make. We're going to try and take this passage, and even though it's a topic in the sense of we're talking about the head covering, we want to look at this passage more by way of just exposition or exegesis of the passage itself, kind of trying to break it down as we're moving, because I think there's a logical progression, even in the way that Paul wrote the things that he did, and then an understanding when he was writing 1 Corinthians, based on several of the things that he said, it seems that two things exist. One, there were multiple questions that were sent to him, apparently, because he specifically says that on more than one occasion. He says, concerning that, which apparently they had asked specifically about. And then secondly, Paul had gotten a good deal of information about some of the things that they were going through at that congregation. And if you go through 1 Corinthians, you find out they were chock full of problems in 1 Corinthians. I mean, all the division that existed, aligning themselves with men rather than with God. They were suing each other, and Paul dealt with that kind of attitude that they had. There were multiple marital questions and issues. There in chapter 5 was the man who was living in an incestuous relationship with, or living with his father's wife, sleeping with his father's wife. And you just continue to read, and as you get farther along, you find out they had spiritual gifts, and instead of just using, they fought over them. This church had some serious struggles, and 1 Corinthians 11 is a part of that. And so we're going to see that Paul's going to be dealing with what I believe, something that he's trying to address that is problematic in the congregation. Now, it's interesting because Paul does start off like he does a lot of times. Even as he's going to address this issue, Paul starts off by saying, I appreciate you guys. I appreciate the attitude that you've demonstrated and the things that we've already talked about. You've been putting those things into practice. He says, be imitators of me as I am of Christ. Now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head covered, with her head uncovered, dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or to shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as a woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman. And all things are from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it's a disgrace for him, but if a woman has long hair, it's her glory? For her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. So a lot of things are said in that passage, no question. And I don't know if you noticed or not, depends on what version you're reading out of. I'm reading out of the ESV, and the ESV repeatedly talks about husband and wife. Your version may say man and woman. A lot of the versions say man and woman. The difficulty is that the Greek word that is translated woman is also translated wife. There is no way except by context to try to determine which is being spoken about. Is it woman or is it wife? The same word that is translated man, that Greek word that is used in this text, is also translated husband. So it really depended on the translators as to whether they were going to translate it husband or man or wife or woman. And they were making that judgment based on the context. I think the context, to me anyway, the context lends itself better toward wife and husband than it does just generically the man and woman, though the principles are going to apply across the board. I think with some of the injunctions that he's making and things that they need to consider. And so we're going to kind of look at this verse by verse to understand what is it Paul is addressing, because I think that there is something that is most concerning to Paul, and it shows up kind of midway through that passage. And what seems to be most concerning to him is that this concept of headship and what happens in this headship. It starts in the very beginning with this, but I want you to understand the head of every man is Christ, the head of the wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. That's the thesis statement, if you will, for this whole section. He's establishing order, and he's establishing headship. And he says, God is the head of Christ, Christ is the head of man or the husband, and man is the head of woman or the wife, whichever way you look at that. But he's establishing an order here, and that's kind of the thesis for the whole thing. He's going to lay that down to try to make a determination as to, let's start this. And you notice the way he writes that? He says, I want you to understand this. That's what he says. He doesn't escape the fact. He said, I want you to understand. So he's trying to get them to acquiesce to a way of thinking, to something that he's about to say to them. He said, I want you to understand this. And the reason he's going to deal with the headship, and the reason that seems to be a thesis statement, is because, as I mentioned, when you get about midway down into the passage, he's going to say, here's the real concern. Every position, there's three heads there. God, Christ, man. God head over Christ, Christ head over man, man head over woman. So he uses that word three times to let you know that there's three heads. And what's going to be a concern to Paul is that all three of those heads receive the honor that they are due. And we'll see why that is when he gets into that passage. But that's a concern to Paul in what he's dealing with here. His concern is not just the action that is going on and what he's trying to regulate there, but the result that that action has, the effect that that action has on the other people that are there. So let's stop for just a second, though, and just say, all right, so it's interesting that we don't struggle so much with the concept of the kind of head God is to Christ, because we understand there's a total equality there. John 1:1 says, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. We have other passages that tell us Jesus was there at the beginning of the creation, that he's involved in the creation. All things that were created, we're told in Colossians, they were all created through him, the same as they were through the Father. There's an absolute equality. So we don't ever think of the headship of God over Christ as being something that is in any way forced or abusive in any sense, that is overbearing. We just wouldn't think of those kind of terms because we think they're absolutely one. Even though there's one that's ahead and one that's not in that role relationship, they're absolutely one. When we think of how Christ is the head over man, it's the same way. We talked about that out of Ephesians 5 just the other day, that the kind of headship that Christ exemplifies, he is a sacrificial, serving, loving, caring, unbreakable, unconditional kind of love in a headship. That's what he does for man. He's not overbearing, so much so that you remember when he was describing the concept of authority, and he said, look, you know how the Gentiles work it. They are that way. They're abusive. They have an authoritarian kind of mindset, domineering and dominant kind of mindset. He said, it's not going to be that way amongst you. That's not the way it works. We are, if we're a husband, we should be a servant leader. Those who serve as shepherds in the Lord's church are servant leaders. It doesn't mean they're not in a position of authority. It's talking about the manner with which they are heads. But we get issues when we get down to man and woman. Somehow or another, man has more of a difficult time filling that role the way that Christ fills it, the way that God fills it. But I think it's important to understand, when Paul says man is the head of woman, he's not trying to set up something that puts these two in some kind of opposition to one another. That's not what he's doing at all. He's trying to get us to understand, even with headship, man and woman, the concept is fit for each other, working together, a single unit. And that's the kind of headship that he's expecting from men, the same as he demonstrates as he is. Nevertheless, he says you do need to understand that there's a principle involved here, because this principle is going to have an application to worship. And he says the overriding principle is still the same, that there is, in fact, some order here, that it's God, that it is Christ, that it is man, and then it is woman. And he establishes that order. We'll come back to that in a minute. So he goes from there, just as far as setting the thesis first. He says, let's just understand the nature of who it is that's in the roles that they are in. And you notice Paul doesn't do anything to describe the roles. I think that's intentional. That's not what this passage is about. Paul is wanting them to understand the bearing of that particular little chart, or if you would, in your mind, the bearing of that on the one subject here that he's going to be dealing with, which is where he goes next, when he starts talking about praying and prophesying. And so he says, every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonors his head. Remember I said that's going to be Paul's big concern here. He's going to say, it's possible for the man to dishonor his head, and his head is who? Christ. And so he says, it's possible for the man to dishonor Christ. He says, but every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, and her head is who? Her husband or the man, whichever way you're looking at that. And he says, for that is one and the same as if her head was shaved. And that's an interesting statement that he's going to make, because he's saying, all right, let's figure out first what's going on. Where it is going on, when it is going on. In other words, what's he dealing with? Because if you're going to be dealing with the covering, which is what he deals with in this chapter, you're going to have to keep it in the context. And everything about this context says if a man is praying or prophesying and doing it in this manner, then that's dishonoring. If a woman is praying and prophesying, then she does it in this manner, that is dishonoring. I think you have to understand that he is dealing specifically with the concept of prophesying and of praying. And I believe because he's attached the two together there, I think there's a strong likelihood that these are, in fact, the exercising of spiritual gifts. Prophecy was absolutely a spiritual gift that was given only. Only God could give the gift of prophecy. He's not talking here just about teaching in a generic sense. He's talking about somebody that is prophesying, and I think by praying, he's not talking about the person who is listening to the prayer, but I think he's talking about the person who is leading that particular prayer. So he says that's what's going on, praying and prophesying. Even if you don't attach the praying to the prophesying, because the prophesying is absolutely a Holy Spirit-given spiritual gift. Does that make sense? Do we all agree on that? There was no other way to get prophecy except God to give you the gift of prophecy. And so that's a God-given gift. And so he is talking about those who prophesy, whether man or woman. And women prophesied in the New Testament, did they not? Acts chapter 21 tells us that Philip, the evangelist, it says, who was one of the seven, he had four daughters who were unmarried. Some versions say four virgin daughters. And he says, so he had these four daughters who were unmarried, and they prophesied. That was prophesied that was going to happen way back in Joel and other places as well, wasn't it? Your young men and your women are going to dream dreams, and they're going to prophesy. He said, so there were women who were exercising spiritual gifts. So when is this?
In other words, when and where? Is this something that is happening in the assembly? Is that what he's dealing with? Because there's no other time that's mentioned other than when she's praying or prophesying. There's no other aspect of worship that is dealt with. Do you understand? Does that make sense? In other words, he's not regulating anything here in the context except the praying and prophesying. That's all he's regulating because that's all he's talking about. And so that's the when of it. But what about the where? I mean, the first thing that we normally do with 1 Corinthians 11 is we want to attach it to the assembly, like this. But that's problematic. And I'll tell you why, to me, that's problematic. Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 14 for just a moment. Because he's not telling them in this particular passage not to prophesy. He's telling them in this passage in 1 Corinthians 11, when you prophesy, you make sure you are covered. Whatever that means, that's what he's telling them. All right, we all on the same page there? All right, so in chapter 14, though, as he's going to be talking about the exercise of spiritual gifts, starting in about verse 26 of this chapter, and he says, what then, brothers? When you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. Let all things be done for building up. Now, there's just one more problem of the Corinthians. They all wanted to show off their gift. So, man, they're just talking. You can just imagine one of those assemblies when Paul's trying to straighten this out. Paul's saying, look, somebody has to stop talking. You can't all be speaking in tongues and prophesying and interpreting and doing all that at the same time. He says, that's difficult. Let all things be done for building up. If any speak in a tongue, let there be only two or three at the most, and each in turn, and let someone interpret. If there's no one to interpret, let each of them keep silent in the church and speak to himself and to God. Let two or three prophets speak, and let the others weigh what is said. If a revelation is made to another sitting there, let the first be silent. For you can all prophesy one by one so that all may learn and all may be encouraged. And the spirits of the prophets are subject to prophets. For God is not a God of confusion. As in all the churches of the saints, the women should keep silent in the churches. For they are not permitted to speak, but should be in submission, as the law also says. If there's anything they desire to learn, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in church. Now, so just stop there for a second. How do you reconcile 1 Corinthians 14 with 1 Corinthians 11? And 1 Corinthians 11 is about the public assembly. Because Paul did not say in 1 Corinthians 14, if women, if you're going to prophesy, you remain covered. Neither in 1 Corinthians 11 did he say women don't prophesy. You keep silent. He said in 1 Corinthians 11, when you prophesy, when you pray, he says you do so covered. He says in 1 Corinthians 14, women, you're not to be prophesying in the public assembly. That's what he's telling them. That's not what the role. He says, let her, in that occasion, let her remain in submission. And let her learn. She has a question. Let her learn from her husband at home. And I've asked somebody to turn in a card on that passage as well. So we're not going to go any more into that side of it tonight. But we will. What exactly is being stipulated for women there and regulated for women there? We'll deal with that if the Lord allows us to on another occasion. But in 1 Corinthians 11, I don't think he's talking about a public assembly. I think he's talking about public prayer and public prophesying, where they would have been outside the assembly, and that their behavior needed to be in such a fashion that it was showing the things that he wanted them to show. And I think that's, for me, that holds true because he did not tell them to be silent. He said, it's okay to prophesy. It's okay to lead that prayer, to pray in that particular situation. He said, but you remain covered. But you get 1 Corinthians 14. He told her, women, just, you keep silent. And he uses the same word, or keep silent there, that he does, same phrase, that he does for the prophet and for the tongue speaker. He's saying, cease talking. That's what he told the tongue speaker, that's what he told the prophet. If somebody else got a prophecy, if there was no interpreter, he said, then let them stay silent. So I think he's actually dealing with something that is outside the assembly, something that is very culturally specific to the things that were going on and the things that he wanted them to understand. Men being covered and women being uncovered when they were in the service. And so he says, you're going to dishonor. I read a story that demonstrated, and I would tell you, probably all of us have seen it. Have you ever just been somewhere and you saw maybe a husband and wife together, and you've seen both, I'm sure. I've seen husbands act in an absolutely unloving way in a public fashion that was a disgrace to them to act that way. The things they said to their wife, the things they did. But I've seen wives act in such a way
that was not at all the kind of woman that God describes. And so it was a disgrace to her and a disgrace to her husband. And I think that's what Paul's going to talk about here. Paul's going to talk about it's possible for her to not only shame herself, but to shame her husband as well by her behavior. And so he's going to talk about the idea of the authority of God next. You notice he says that for that is one and the same as if her head was shaved. He's just saying whatever he's describing is the covering. And whatever is she supposed to do to be covered? He said if she's not going to do it, he said it's just like if she had shaved her head. Well, why would he say that? Because they were in a culture that was indicative of something. Women who shaved their heads or cut their hair very short was normally a sign that they were available as a prostitute. Keep in mind, he's writing this to the Corinthians, and so they are in a Greek culture that was just absolutely filled with pagan worship. And so he's saying, this is what people are going to think. People are going to think that it's the same as if you were a prostitute. He says, you may as well, it's just like your head was shaved. What would people think of your husband if you went out in public and your head was shaved in that culture? If your hair was even cut real short, they would think, wow, what a shame. What a display that is. And so I think that he's indicating that to him. He goes on to the authority of God in this passage. And he says, for if a woman is not covered, let her also be shorn. Now, just stop there for just a second. Because this, to me, this would indicate that you cannot be dealing with the hair as a covering. He's going to talk about the hair later in the passage. People sometimes will say, well, the hair is the covering. Well, the hair can't be the covering. This passage doesn't make any sense. Because if she doesn't have any hair, what are you going to shave? He said, if she's not covered, then he says, let her be shorn. Go ahead and shave her. If she doesn't have any hair, there's nothing really to shave. But by the same token, if the covering is hair, what is the man to do in this passage? Because it says, if he is covered, he's a dishonor to his head, Jesus Christ. So can a man have hair and pray? Does he need to be shaved? I think he's clearly dealing with some kind of covering that is other than the hair, some kind of artificial covering. He says, but if it is shameful for a woman to be shorn or shaved, let her be covered. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he's the image and glory of God, but a woman is the glory of man. For man is not from woman, but woman from man, nor was man created for the woman, but woman for the man. For this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angel. British Angel is not going to have time to do that, I suppose, at all. I'll mention it, but it's the toughest part of this passage, without a doubt. And then the thing that is not helpful is read what a bunch of people have written on it. You read what a bunch of people have written on, and then I'm even more confused than I was probably before. But he is talking about the authority of God in this passage. He's saying, this is why this is so critical, as I mentioned before. If she's not going to do whatever it is Paul is addressing that she do, she's going to bring dishonor to her husband. And that's a problem. It's a problem for her, because if she brings shame to herself, she brings shame to her husband. And if she brings shame to her husband, then she brings shame to God. That's what God is concerned about. He's saying, what is she doing to make sure that she is showing forth the glory of God? And he's trying to help them to understand that's the crux of this issue. Like it is with so many other things that God tells us. Why we have to do certain things the way we do. Why we have to behave a certain way that we do. He says is because people will reflect badly on me. And if we reflect badly on God, we lose the opportunity to help people come to Him. And that's what He's concerned about. Remember, that's exactly, as we said, what David was told by Nathan. You've given occasion. You behaved in such a way that was disgraceful to God's people and gives God a bad name. In Colossians, when Paul talked to them about husband and wife relationship, he uses a similar phrase that he's going to use here in this passage in a moment. And he says, you know what? Here's what I'm telling you to do. He says, act with your spouse in a way that is fitting, is the word that he uses. It's fitting.
is that it's just right. You know what it's supposed to look like. And he's saying to them, and he's going to tell them in a minute, examine yourselves here, look at this. But he says, understand, what are we doing to either bring glory to God or take glory away from God? And so he says, man has the authority from God, so he doesn't need to be covered. He says, when man is out, let him not be covered. Well, if you understand their culture, that's a problem as well, because that's not an absolute. Can you remember any time when any of the men did wear head coverings in order to worship God? Absolutely. It says the priest. When Aaron was anointed high priest, he was specifically told, those around him were told, take the turban and put it on his head. It isn't an issue of whether or not it is just the covering, but he's speaking to them in their culture, in their customs, and in their things that they understood. Well, it was very typical in pagan worship, especially in Greek cities and in Roman cities, pagan worship. You've seen the togas, that those guys wear the big robes and the clothes. They would flip those up, and that's the way they would worship. And so men that would stand out and pray or prophesy on the streets as they would claim prophecy, but as they would be teaching that way, they're flipped up and have got that covering on. And he's saying, don't demonstrate the kind of worship that would show. God has said, you're the image and glory of God. You uncover because this is what I told you to do as man. But woman has a special privilege here that didn't always exist. And he's saying, so she needs to understand she must have a symbol of authority on her head. That's indicating something. One of two things, I think. And probably both. It's indicating the concept of submission in that culture. That she is indicating, I am in submission to my husband. Yeah, David? God says to the men here, that's not the way you pray. You've got my authority to pray and to prophesy. But she needs to have a symbol to indicate she has the authority of God and a symbol that indicates that she's in a proper place of submission. Which takes us to, so if you talk about that symbol then, and the veil that they wore, because as we see that practice sometimes today, and everybody here has probably seen women that wear a covering at some time when they worship, have you not? And it usually is constituted of what? What constitutes that covering? What's that? Lace. Some kind of lace, some kind of small thing. That is not at all what Paul would have been dealing with. I think even if you come to the conviction that you need to have a covering, and I would tell you, you need to have a true covering like they did. They were veiling their whole head, normally their face as well. And they might have removed what was in front of their mouth if they were prophesying. But they veiled, like what we would see people from the Mideast with now, completely veiled in order to indicate submission to their husbands. And so he says they need to have that symbol on their head. And what I think he's regulating here is, in Galatians, he said things like, there is neither male nor female. And that's good. We'll get to that section next, where he talks about not only the authority of God, but the equality of male and female. But what happens when you take women who have been in one culture and have been taught a certain way and raised a certain way, and now you say, now you have this special gift of prophecy? What's the danger in that? What's that? Well, no question. The Corinthians had that on both male and female side. The pride in the gift. But there's going to be a tendency to exercise the gift, wouldn't you think? I've got the gift of prophecy. I'm going to prophesy. Paul is saying, be careful. I think he's saying, be careful with that. Because you're trying to show the world something. And there's still a submissive spirit here. I think they were taking their freedoms too far. They now had this additional freedom. And Paul is having to regulate and say, It's right at the very beginning. I want you to understand. Remember that he said that? God, Christ, man, woman. He was establishing an order, and they needed to understand that. And so he says, nevertheless, neither is man independent of woman, nor the woman independent of man in the Lord. For as a woman came from man, he says, even so man also comes from a woman, but all things are from God. This is about, he's teaching the absolute equality and codependence of man and woman in this passage. Now, he is teaching there's an order, but it's an issue of order, not value. He's not devaluing the women by regulating what he is doing. He said previously in the passage, he said, God did not make the woman first. He made the man first. He said, God did not make the man for the woman. He made the woman for the man. Now, you tell men that, and they get that out of line. They have to use that concept as far as the leadership role that they have. But as he's establishing this equality, he's saying that you've got to keep that in balance, because the fact that you are equal before God does not change the order in which God established things. And so I think he's trying to make sure that they understand the order with which he established things. And so then he's going to make his argument from culture. That's how he's going to end this. He's going to say, look, just judge for yourself. He's going to ask rhetorical questions. He's not asking this based on biblical knowledge that they would have. He's asking, judge among yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? How would she know the answer to that? Because he's saying, judge this for yourselves. You tell me, is that a proper thing? Is that fitting for you to pray with your head uncovered? Why would he say that? How would she know that? Absolutely. This, as she could look around her, do you not know, women, things that are fitting in our society? Things that are proper? That's what he's asking her. The word is used proper in some of these versions as well. Is it proper like it is in the ESV? That's a very strong word that deals with culture and custom. Is that proper? We understand there are things that are proper and not proper. Correct? They don't always remain the same, though, do they? Culture changes. Give me an example of something that was not proper before that is not considered necessarily improper now.
Divorce.
What's that?
Divorce.
Yeah, and I would put that in the category of used to be considered wrong, and no longer considered wrong.
Women wearing pants.
What's that?
Women wearing pants.
Yeah, great point. Women wearing pants. Period. Much less to a worship assembly. Right? I mean, it was a long time after women wore pants before women wore pants to a worship assembly. But there was a time when that would have just been considered improper. If you came out as a woman dressed in pants, that would have been considered improper by culture. So a Christian woman should do what? What should a Christian woman do if culture tells her that's improper? Yeah, she ought to be dressing differently, hadn't she? Why? Because the whole concept is here, he's saying, look, if a woman acts in a way that's improper, she dishonors her head, which is the husband or the man. And if he acts in a way that's improper, then he dishonors his head, which is Christ. But if her head dishonoring her head automatically dishonors his head as well, and dishonors his head. So it's a dishonoring of God. So he's saying there's a proper. He says, I'm just asking you to look around. That considered proper for a woman to remove her veil? Because she would have been wearing one. He said, some of the versions even say, let her remain covered. But the idea was, she's got a veil on. He's saying, don't take that veil off. That's a sign to people that you understand that there are role relationships. And so he makes that argument from culture. He says, you be the judge. What's the decorum of the day? What's proper? What's accepted? And so then he's going to make an argument based on hair. Just to make an argument, I think. He's saying, look, he says, you judge proper regarding hair. That makes sense. He said, doesn't nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a cover. Now, here's where we get challenged on that.
What word is most challenging in there? All right, well, the covering. It says her hair is given to her for a covering. But what else is it saying there? We don't. One of the words we don't really like when it applies to us. You notice what he said? He goes, doesn't nature teach you? How does nature teach you that long hair is a dishonor to men and long hair is an honor to women? How does nature teach you that? You ever think about that? In other words, were men just born where their hair doesn't grow long? That's just a shame. Women's hair automatically just grows long, but a man's doesn't. What's the nature here? Well, I would tell you Ephesians chapter 2 would help us understand that. Because Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2, he says, we are by nature children of wrath. Now, so you have to ask yourself, are we born children of wrath? In other words, is that the way we were made? Created by nature, in other words, born into? The word here is physis in the Greek. And it carries the idea of that which is learned from that which is around us. And it's just saying, so if that which is natural, doesn't just the natural setting tell you that for a man to have long hair is a shame and for a woman to have short hair is a shame? We're in Greek culture again, and heavily dominated by the Roman Empire. And I know this is strange to think about, but read some articles sometimes on those who have written, what kind of hairstyle did Jesus have? Well, we know because we've got all the photos. So, you know, he always had that long hair.
It was blonde.
What? Yeah. So, you know, what kind of, a lot of the scholars feel that it's very likely that he and his disciples would have had much, much shorter hair, almost as would have been typical in society at that time. That gist which was generally accepted in society, the men would have had very much shorter hair. And so I've seen some sketches of Jesus. I'm not saying they're correct. I'm just saying, seeing some sketches where the artists put like the Roman Empire style haircuts on them, cut much shorter. Some of the things that are written from that time say exactly the same thing, that a man, that, including Jews, that have things written that say that the hair can't come down into the eyes, that can't come down beyond a certain length on the ears or the collar. That stipulation, that's what was acceptable. But I think he's dealing with culture just saying, look, you look around you and you understand, you cut your hair short, that sends the wrong message to your woman in their culture. Now, we can't feel exactly the same as they did, but we got some serious problems, don't we? I mean, because here would be my question. If a woman's hair and a man's hair are the same length, doesn't one of them have to be too short or one of them have to be too long? It'd be physically impossible for that not to happen if what he's trying to do is regulate the hair. But there were people in the Bible with long hair, not only the ones that had vows not to cut it. There were others like Absalom and others that had the long hair. I don't think he's saying by nature as if it's an automatic defined thing. But for them, that which was natural around them, that culture that was around them, indicated that was not an acceptable thing. He said, and if you understand that, then you also ought to be able to look around at the same people and understand praying without a covering on your head is also not acceptable. That's just culturally unacceptable. And because of that, then it created a problem for them. So I would tell you, for me today, I think that's what he's dealing with. He's saying that This is an issue with the church at Corinth, with the things that they were dealing with. And two things come to my mind. If truly this is about the exercising of spiritual gifts, then it wouldn't have any application to us today in practice, only in principle. The principle that he started with, the thesis, never changes. That's not a Corinthian practice. God is the head of Christ. Christ is the head of man. Man is the head of woman. However you're going to use that, that would still apply to us today. Every principle stated in this passage would be just as binding on us today. How we execute it might be different. Does a veil in our culture, in other words, a woman puts up a veil and veils her face. For you, does that indicate to you that is the authority of God and submission to her husband? In our culture. It doesn't carry that idea at all to us. And so it's not going to be the same issue as it was to them. Are there cultures where that is the case? To them. It absolutely. And I think God would say the same thing.
if I was living with my wife in a culture where it was a shame for her to be in public unveiled, then I would tell her she needs to be veiled so that she does not bring shame on herself and bring shame on me and bring shame on God. I think he is dealing very clearly with things that apply to them either because of the gifts they were exercising or at the very least because of the culture that they were in and demonstrating. And so Paul says if there's any contentions about that, he says we don't have any other such custom. And that passage is almost as difficult as the because of the angels. Some say that it is no other custom. Some just say that we have no such custom. If you look it up in the Greek in the interlinear, you can see why they did it both ways. Because the word is difficult to understand exactly what he was saying. But I don't think he's saying all of the churches everywhere agree with this as much as he's saying that this is not a doctrine specifically that is universal, but I think he says it does have that cultural application. But because of the angels, very difficult passage, but it appears, and I'm just going to tell you what, for me, when you go back and you look at that, it appears to me that he's saying one of two things. One, because the angels also understand, as is mentioned in Jude, the angels also understand the need for the proper order of things. And so when you look at the angels who got out of their role and position, that's what's described regarding Satan and the things that go along with the overstepping one's bounds because they had free will also. So I think he's either just talking about because of that even they understand, or secondly, there are several scholars that feel when you read a passage like Revelation 2 and 3, the angel of the church of and each one of those, feel that there's an angel that is specifically assigned by God to every congregation of his people. And so he's saying because the angels are watching God's people, then you need to be doing what God has told you to do. Not that God needs reports back. God is all-knowing. But there's many descriptions in Scripture as if the word goes through a channel like that, whether it's Christ and the Spirit and then to the Father. But so one of those two things for me seems to make the most sense, that either angels are seeing exactly what's going on in a worship service or in life, and so he's saying that God's watching out that way. But for me, it seems to be more an issue of he's saying that the angels have already shown you what happens when you step out of the order that God has given. And so you consequently have Satan and all that goes with that side. So does that make sense at all? Is that helpful at all? Not helpful? It's a tough passage, but I do think that Paul eventually gets to the point of saying the principles of God have to be applied. Anything we choose to do in worship, corporately or privately, the principles of God have to be applied. But then Paul is also saying there is no question that the culture you are in has an effect on those principles and how they are applied. And that's the nature. But I think that's why God did it the way he did it, is so that it is adaptable to every culture throughout all time. And we can still show him honor. Women can honor men, or wives their husbands. Men can honor Christ. Christ already did honor God in everything that he did. And so he says we certainly have the option to do the same thing. So hopefully that provides some clarification or didn't muddy it up even worse for you. It's a difficult passage, but I do think that we need to understand why we choose to either wear or not wear, if you're a woman, a covering, or why, if you're a man, why you teach that it should be or should not be, or does not need to be worn. So I appreciate your listening to all of that. We haven't talked at all about coming to Christ, but the song that we're about to sing is just kind of a great song to talk about that relationship. And we hope if there is anybody here tonight that needs to come to him, that you'd do that. Do you know my Jesus? Isn't that a great question? Do you know my Jesus? If you don't, then you need to. And we'd love to share him with you. For those of us that are Christians, may we always be thinking about how is it that we're doing everything we can to be pleasing to our God.
Thank you for your attention. If we can help you tonight, let us know while we stand and while we sing.